Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the firing today of Bill O'Reilly, Fox News' top-rated anchor, which was announced in a letter to staff by Rupert Murdoch and his sons James and Lachlan. Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society, joins us to discuss the accumulating accusations of sexual harassment that continue to emerge even after the New York Times revealed settlements with five women who were paid a total of $13 million. This prompted at least 60 advertisers to boycott O'Reilly and Fox, and with the O'Reilly scandal on top of the Ailes scandal, apparently the message finally reached Rupert Murdoch that serial sexual harassment is not only bad, it's bad for business. Then we'll look into the snap election called for June the 8th by Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May in the hope that she can increase her majority to get through the next 2 years of the Brexit transition out of the EU. The author of Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union, Harold Clark, a professor of political and policy studies at the University of Texas, joins us. He is the co-investigator of the British election study and a visiting professor at the University of Manchester, and we will discuss the likelihood that the UK's opposition Labour Party will suffer even greater losses than they did in the last election. Then finally, we'll speak with Christopher Arndt, who serves on the board of the Natural Resources Defence Council and is the author of a new book, The Right's Road to Serfdom: The Danger of Conservatism Unbound, from Hayek to Trump. He joins us to discuss the freedom fraud foisted on America by the Koch brothers and the authoritarian strongman conservatism that drives the American right today, which runs counter to the principles of liberty that conservatives and libertarians espouse. And joining us now is Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics: How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Cassino.
It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
And Bill O'Reilly is finished at Fox News. It's quite a surprise, although not in terms of the news cycle, but the idea that the top-rated performer, or anchor, I guess, to be a little more fair, who's been there since the very beginning of Fox News, who's beats everybody else in the ratings, is gone, and not without some problems. But why do you think it was such a painfully slow learning process for the Murdochs, particularly after Roger Ailes and his disgraceful behavior? So what's the problem there with them? I mean, it seems that they've really had a hard time learning. The obvious thing is that not only is sexual harassment bad, it's also bad for business.
Well, right. And it wasn't until very recently that it became clear that it was actually going to hurt the bottom line. So Bill O'Reilly, while he was engaging in serial sexual harassment, was a problem in that they were having to pay settlements, but it wasn't actually a financial problem for them because the amount of revenue he was bringing in more than offset whatever problems, whatever settlements they were having to pay off. This became a real problem when the advertiser boycott took hold, and we saw this happen previously several years ago to Glenn Beck, where Glenn Beck had said things that were offensive, even though he had very, very high ratings. Once advertisers pulled all their ads, they really had no choice but to cancel him. With Glenn Beck, they actually kept him on the air for 2 months with no national advertisers. It was pretty bad at the end. It was all people trying to sell you survivalist kits or try and exchange your worthless American money for valuable gold. And eventually, they had no choice but to take him off the air. And the same thing happened here with Bill O'Reilly. The other issue here is actually one of civil liability for Fox News. Basically, the fact that it's now become clear that they have so many settled sexual harassment allegations opens them up legally to a lot of trouble. Essentially, if one manager or one person at a company is engaging in sexual harassment and the company is doing what they're supposed to be doing about it, the company isn't at fault. However, it can be shown that the company isn't doing anything about it, the company knows it's going on and isn't stopping it, then the company is not only liable, it's actually liable for punitive damages. And those punitive damages, knowing how many other victims potentially are out there, if you're Lachlan and James, the new managers at Fox News, you don't want to open yourself up to that kind of liability.
Well, my understanding is that the U.S. attorney, Preet Bharara, who was fired by Trump, was looking into a number of things, including the prosecution of the bag man for Turkish dictator Erdogan, who was dealing with the Iranians, money laundering, and sanction busting for them. He's apparently, they're trying to get him off, and Preet Bharara was in the way. But they also, the Trump people also, I think, were working on Murdoch's behalf, weren't they? Because Preet Bharara was looking into the liability that Fox has for not informing its shareholders about these secret payments.
Well, right. So this is an issue of fiduciary responsibility for Fox, given that a lot of these were Fox paying on behalf of Roger Ailes and on behalf of Bill O'Reilly. Fox should have disclosed that. Now, Fox claimed that these were personnel matters and therefore were not subject to disclosure, that they weren't actually legal settlements. And you could make the claim that it wasn't Fox itself being sued, but the individuals. So that would have been a interesting case legally. But, you know, the issue here really is Bill O'Reilly and the role, the special role Bill O'Reilly himself had played. We have to remember, Bill O'Reilly had been allied with Roger Ailes, working with him since before Fox News existed, back in the 90s on syndicated shows like Inside Edition. And so Bill O'Reilly was one of the last vestiges of that original group of Roger Ailes loyalists. And with his departure, we're left basically with just Sean Hannity from that original lineup. And it really seems like James and Lachlan are making good on their promise to reconfigure Fox. And we've seen voices outside of that core group at Fox expressing hope that, oh, this means we're going to be free to be a real news organization. I mean, Shep Smith has been particularly open about this, saying, you know, the new management came in and said, we can criticize the president, we can do whatever we need to do to be a serious news organization. Now, whether being a serious news organization translates into ratings, well, we'll see. But there's also very little indication that Bill O'Reilly is responsible for all the ratings he got. Bill O'Reilly has a personal following. You can tell he has, what, three bestsellers on the bestseller list right now. But relative to the other shows on Fox News, he doesn't get that big of a ratings bump over what you see at the hour before him or the hour after him. Most Fox News viewers are Fox News viewers rather than being fans of one show in particular, as you'd find in other networks. So financially, it may make sense for them to get rid of him. And while whoever replaces him will certainly get lower ratings, at least initially, than Bill O'Reilly did, you know, if they're paying him one-third of what they were paying O'Reilly, and O'Reilly had just renegotiated his contract after Roger Ailes had exited, then it could still be financially beneficial for Fox News. And as long as they're making money, no one's going to ask too many questions.
And again, I'm speaking with Dan Cassino, who's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as director of the experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. So what is it about this culture of misogyny and sexual harassment and these serial sexual harassers, Roger Ailes in charge of Fox News and Bill O'Reilly, their biggest star? Now, obviously, Sean Hannity wasn't a part of that club, but is there any sort of psychological explanation for it in terms of these kind of junkyard dog, yapping, hard right-wing sort of faux populist politics? I mean,
I'm not sure it's a general rule that people who are, you know, powerful men on the right are going to engage in sexual harassment. However, this particular culture within Fox News, remember, Roger Ailes had gotten his start in the 1960s when the sort of thing we call sexual harassment was normal office behavior. And he didn't seem to adapt. And moreover, he'd been successful enough, he didn't necessarily see any reason he had to change his behavior. And so what was acceptable at the top with Roger Ailes was certainly acceptable down the line. And that's the sort of toxic culture that leads to endemic sexual harassment in an organization like Fox News. I think there's also a rejection of the idea that you need to have diversity in the boardroom and at high levels of decision-making. If you'd had more women at higher levels of decision-making, it's likely someone would have sounded the alarm earlier on this. And so maybe the reason you get organizations that are more right-wing being more prone to this sort of scandal is because they're less diverse at the top. And so there's no one to come in and say, from another perspective, hey, this isn't okay. And we saw on Fox News, the second actually a woman was elevated up to those top ranks having a primetime show, Roger Ailes came down pretty quickly after Megyn Kelly was in there, because we've heard about the meetings. You know, Roger Ailes gathers the troops, all the primetime hosts, says, all right, here's the strategy, here's what we're going to say to defend these sexual harassment allegations. And Megyn Kelly said, nope, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be any part in this. I'm not going to defend you. Once a woman gets in those high ranks, it's much harder to cover up and hide this behavior. So organizations that have women at those high ranks aren't going to have as many problems.
Right, but Megyn Kelly left Fox. She obviously was uncomfortable there.
Well, she was uncomfortable even after Roger Ailes was ousted. We can understand now she was actually still saying, well, Bill O'Reilly was part of this too. There was this old boys club at Fox News. And, you know, getting rid of one member, that didn't clear out that entire culture. Moreover, if you're Megyn Kelly, she really thinks she has a career well outside of Fox News. She wants a career much more like Katie Couric than one like Gretchen Carlson.
So Rupert Murdoch himself, this must have been painful for him. I mean, it's pretty amazing that he didn't notice all this stuff going on in his company, but apparently the Suns did, and the Suns are trying to reorient Fox into, you know, at least trying to find a way to bring the millennial generation in, which seems like a bit of a chimera, but they're trying, you know. So do you think, though, that there's just this hardcore of people that, and it's an old, let's call it the angry old white demographic. Mm-hmm. Is that what it is?
So, Fox News, you know, I think this is a misconception people have about Fox News, that, oh, it's old white guys that watch it. And it's just not the case. Fox News actually has a pretty diverse demographic reach if we look at all the day parts from morning until evening. And a lot of that's because in a lot of public places, Fox News is just the channel that's left on. So you get a lot of incidental viewing. And because of that, Fox News audience isn't even majority conservative. About 25% of liberals in America report they watch Fox News at least once a month. So it's a relatively diverse audience for most of the day. The evening viewers watching O'Reilly and Hannity tend to be more conservative, tend to be older, tend to be whiter. But there is some diversity in the audience. The big problem they've had is that every attempt they've made to try and bring in a younger audience has failed. And Megyn Kelly was their big gamble to try and get a younger audience. They brought Megyn Kelly in, and her audience actually wound up having an older median age than Bill O'Reilly's audience. Her median audience was 70, or median viewer was 71 years old, as opposed to O'Reilly, who's right around 68 for his median age of audience. So they haven't figured out how to reach younger viewers. In their defense, no news channel has figured out how to reach younger viewers. The most successful has been CNN, who is reaching younger viewers by not showing news, instead doing documentaries and Anthony Bourdain. So I'm not sure that's really a solution either. So this is not a problem just Fox News has. This is a problem everyone has. Moreover, if I'm Rupert Murdoch, I'm not sure this is a problem at all. Yeah, I've got old viewership, but so does CBS. They're the most successful channel on television. So the mere fact your audience is old doesn't mean they don't have disposable income, doesn't mean advertisers don't value them. So you have to ask, is it worth alienating that older, loyal audience in order to try and get a younger audience that, you know, might be just getting all the news from Snapchat and Instagram instead?
So what then do you think happened with Rupert Murdoch? Because my understanding was that he's very loyal to O'Reilly and recognized, and the letter that he and the Sun sent out to the staff today, you know, had the usual sort of homilies about how great and how successful O'Reilly was. But my understanding is that the thing that really stuck in Murdoch's craw was the idea that he didn't want to give the New York Times, which he hates and is competing with, that's why he bought the Wall Street Journal. He didn't want to give them credit for being the ones that drove O'Reilly out by revealing these $13 million in payments to five women.
Well, certainly that's part of Rupert Murdoch's thinking. But we also understand Rupert Murdoch with Fox News has never been much of a hands-on manager. You know, from Ailes' description, Murdoch's management came down to how much money did you make this quarter? What's your viewership like? And as long as Ailes was making money and, you know, getting enough viewers, Murdoch didn't have any more questions. He left it up to Ailes to run this place however he wants. And it seems like Murdoch is having to take a little more of a hand in running things since Ailes is gone. And surely this does have to stick in Murdoch's craw that the New York Times gets this scoop and gets this coup, and O'Reilly's forced out partially because of their reporting. But this is also a financial decision, a business decision. I mean, even if you could just keep on, if all you're doing is going to keep on paying these settlements till the end of time, I have to imagine that James and Lachlan and Rupert Murdoch would all be fine paying out an extra $10 million a year and just basically calling that part of his compensation package. The issue really is about losing advertisers, even though they weren't directly losing advertisers because the advertisers were just moving their ads to other parts of the day. They were having to sell ads and run fewer ads during that hour, which is normally very profitable, and they were exposing themselves to potentially enormous civil liability. I mean, the problem comes, you can pay $10 million in a lawsuit every year for Bill O'Reilly. The problem comes when you have a $500 million punitive suit because you haven't handled sexual harassment problems. And there's no way they're going to be willing to pay that out. And that's really what they're trying to get ahead of here.
So it wasn't as if Fox was starting, the advertisers, about, what, 60, have pulled their advertising from O'Reilly. I thought that they were also starting to pull them from Fox itself.
We do have, so there's two groups. So there are advertisers that have pulled from Fox itself, saying we're not going to run ads on Fox News. But that's a much smaller group than the, and it doesn't include nearly as many large national accounts as those that have just pulled from O'Reilly. They said we, you know, and so most of the advertisers that have pulled their ads have just said, look, you know, they've already bought the ads are already paid for. They're just shifting the ads. So, okay, instead of doing it during O'Reilly, put that ad on during Hannity. And there just weren't enough ads that were people were still okay with running during O'Reilly to even fill up the ad room they had on O'Reilly. For the past couple weeks, O'Reilly's ads have been down to 12 or 11 minutes an hour, where normally you'd expect it to be somewhere between 18 and 22 minutes. So they've lost a lot of revenue there. Now, there was a strategy for a while, well, we'll just wait this out. Eventually, the advertisers will come back. But it didn't look like that was happening. And they're also getting pushback from major ad buyers. We have to remember, upfronts are coming pretty soon. And so the ad rates for Fox News as a whole might wind up dropping if we have this advertiser boycott. It's one thing if people say, oh, we're going to shift our ads around. Once upfronts come and all the TV advertisers are selling their or deciding where they're going to place their ads, it's a real problem if people are saying, well, let's just avoid Fox for this quarter. And that would be a major hit to their revenue. And they just weren't going to let that happen.
Well, I guess, you know, this is a I guess to some extent this is the other side of what happened with Dan Rather. You know, there were a lot of right-wingers wanted to get rid of him, and they were thrilled when CBS dropped him. And a lot of liberals and left-wingers have really been driven crazy by O'Reilly, and they're thrilled that he's gone. But none of that begins to deal with the real issue here is what Fox has done to American journalism. And I used to spend a lot of time in the Soviet Union and met a lot of journalists there with TASS and Pravda, and most of them were KGB guys. But it's the ones that were journalists, you felt sorry for them because they literally had to write the party line. And that's what Fox does. It's the Pravda of the Republican Party. It goes against the whole idea of American freedom that, you know, that the press is not the PR operation of the government. That happens in totalitarian societies, not in a free society like America. And my sense is that Fox has really done terrible damage to that idea of, you know, the fourth estate being separate from the government. They basically are the mouthpiece of the Trump administration.
Well, you know, I think I push back on that on two points. The first is that I'm not sure that this idea of a nonpartisan press is really that old. I mean, in America, the press was insanely partisan, really up until the start of the Cold War, when we had this kind of enforced neutrality on partisan issues from the press and this rise of a, you know, professional class of journalists. But that's really not, that's an invention of the early to mid-20th century. Prior to that, if we go back to the founding, the newspapers were all partisan and explicitly partisan. I'd say in every way, Fox News is much more of a throwback to the era of Jefferson and Jackson than it is, you know, a new model. I think what Fox News, the big contribution Fox News has made, is said, hey, look, here is a way to make money off of journalism. And that's something no one else has been able to do in the quantity that Fox News has done in the 21st century. They figured a way to monetize journalism. The problem is that the way of monetizing journalism is to make it less journalistic. And as you say, they're really parroting a mouthpiece. In some cases, I would say they're not the mouthpiece of the Republican Party. They are doing a better job than the Republican Party is doing. There's a reason that, you know, George W. Bush hired Tony Snow to be his spokesman, because Fox News, Tony Snow and Fox News, did a better job than George Bush was with putting out his own message. And I think that's partially because Roger Ailes was such a genius at messaging. But the problem, I think, for American journalism is that Fox News showed the way to make a profit is to be less journalistically rigorous. And all the news organizations we've seen that have become profitable since then, places like BuzzFeed, that have figured out, the news content itself doesn't matter. If that's the only way journalism can be profitable, and if we expect that journalism has to be profitable, then we've got a real problem on our hands going forward.
Well, Dan Cozzino, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure as always, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dan Cozzino. He's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the snap election called for June the 8th by Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May.
Another one bites the dust, and another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey, hey, I'm gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Howard Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. He's the author of Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in Britain. And his latest book coming out next week is Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Clark.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Harold. And it seems to me that Prime Minister Theresa May of the UK has pulled off a pretty effective snap election, which is going to be held, I believe, on June the 8th.
That's correct.
And she's got slim majority of 17, and it looks like she will increase her majority considerably. And it looks as this will be at the expense of Labour, which is in disarray. So let's begin with the first premise, that it will increase her majority.
Yes. Most of the people I've been talking to who are, quite knowledgeable and close to British party politics suggest that that's exactly what's going to happen. And I was looking at some projections today that show the Conservatives going as high as 392 seats, with Labour falling, as you suggest, all the way back to 170 from their present 232, which would be just the worst showing they've had since 1931.
And can you attribute that to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and the divisions that he's created within the party? Or is there something else going on?
I think that the divisions in Labour are a substantial reason for their problems. And, of course, the battle has been over the last few years between the Blairites / Brownites on the one hand, the sort of Westminster bubble group, versus the sort of hardline left activists led by Jeremy Corbyn. The other thing, of course, which has hurt Labour a lot, is their loss of Scotland, where they used to be the absolutely dominant party. And, of course, all of that has gone away to the SNP now.
So what is the split there within the... I mean, there's a lot of people in Labour that aren't happy with Corbyn. He welcomed this snap election, which seems odd.
It does seem odd.
And,
very odd.
And if you go back to Brexit itself, he vacillated on Brexit. And he wasn't clearly for or against it. And I think that's cost the party a lot, hasn't it?
I think so, too. I think that Corbyn's failure to lead Labour into the Brexit campaign with a very resolute Remain stance has really hurt them. And of course, Corbyn historically was opposed to the European Union, and he views it very much as a sort of a Davos club, sort of a global capitalist. And of course, this is very much anathema to him. And in the end, he basically did nothing during the campaign. And people I've talked to working for Remain, including Will Straw, who was their director, tell me that they couldn't even get their calls returned by Corbyn and his advisors.
But it wouldn't have taken much of an effort to have switched the vote, because the Leave people on Brexit won narrowly.
That's right. It would only have taken about three people out of 100 to turn that around. So the decision that Corbyn made may well have been very consequential. There were other things, of course, that happened in the campaign. The sort of de facto, sort of accidental, really, decision of the Leave side to really run two campaigns. The sort of hard populist campaign led by Nigel Farage and UKIP on the one hand, and then the sort of polite Eurosceptic campaign that became the official Leave campaign. And so they had sort of this two-prong attack going, totally accidental, but it proved to be very effective.
Again, I'm speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And he's the author of Affluence, Austerity and Electoral Change in Britain. And his latest book coming out next week is Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. Well, you obviously have to talk about Brexit in terms of what Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, has just done in calling for a snap election. She's basically saying the country's united behind getting on with the Brexit, but Westminster is divided.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've made clear, that if Corbyn wouldn't have been so feckless, he may have been able to prevent Brexit, which certainly to my mind is a catastrophe. So why is it that May has gotten behind it so fulsomely, in the sense that it's the will of the people, when it's really the will? It's like the elections that took place, or the referendum that just took place in Turkey. Well, you know, it's not exactly the will of the people that Erdogan won by a squeaker. So what explains that fulsome kind of embrace of Brexit on the part of the Conservatives and Theresa May?
Well, of course, historically, over the last 2 to 3 decades, particularly since the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, the Conservative Party as a whole has been deeply divided on Europe. And indeed, at the time of the Brexit referendum a year ago, the party was very deeply divided, and a number of senior Tories, came out in opposition to the Prime Minister Cameron. And openly campaigned for Brexit, the most famous, of course, being Boris Johnson. And we could well argue that Boris's intervention was something that very much helped to tip the scales. After, the ensuing leadership contest was one that May, who's sort of famous for being quiet about things and keeping her cards close to her, actually had nominally at least supported Remain. But I suspect that she was closeted in favor of Brexit, certainly not very opposed to it. And I think she's viewed it now as, a political calculation. One of the things to note, Ian, is that recent public opinion polls, conducted since Brexit have shown us that there really is not any sentiment to rerun this, to rerun the Brexit referendum. And I was just looking at a poll this morning showing that 69% want to get on with it, and only 21% want to redo it. So, I'm sure she looked very closely at the polling evidence before deciding to make her move.
So, as you've mentioned, she'll probably get a substantial majority at the expense of Labour. Will the Liberal Democrats, they're sort of irrelevant in any case, aren't they?
Had a disastrous performance in 2015 one of their work, they went from basically they lost 50 seats out of their, you know, had close to 60, and they were down to 8. Right now, if you look at their polling, they're running a little bit better than they did at that time. They're up around 11 or 12%, and of course, a lot depends for a small party like that where those votes, how concentrated they are. And it looks like projections right now are suggesting that they may well, you know, get as many as 20 seats this time around. But basically, they're not going to go. I would suggest to you that they have no real political future coming out of this election any more than they have over the past 5 years. You know.
So let's turn to the Scottish Nationalists.
Yes.
My understanding is that they feel like Brexit stabbed them in the back after they had their referendum about whether or not to stay in the UK. So is there some restive moves there now?
Sure. And indeed, Nicola Sturgeon, who is the leader of the SNP, which is the governing party, of course, in Scotland, has been openly calling now for a second independence referendum. And Theresa May, in response, has said, "Well, not now," which probably means not ever. And of course, it's ultimately her call. And if she wins this big majority we've been talking about, I suspect she will say, "Well, we're just not going to do that for a while, and then that'll be the end of it, effectively, at least for a generation."
So what's happening to all of those Polish immigrants that kind of got scapegoated and victimized in the Brexit campaign? It was an odd campaign. I mean, obviously, the influx of refugees from Syria did play a big role in,
sure,
and certainly contributed to the xenophobia that Nigel Farage, this absolutely anxious, horrible person, I just find him so distasteful. And I believe he's not particularly popular in England, but he's certainly popular with Donald Trump. He obviously took advantage of that, but they also beat up on the on Polish plumbers.
Oh, they sure did. One of the things we have, you're speaking of books a few minutes ago, introducing me, we have a new book called Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the EU, coming out with Cambridge a week from today, as a matter of fact. And one of the things we find in there is that while the UKIPers are very distinctive in terms of their demographics, in terms of their attitudes towards minorities, it turns out that they are extraordinarily similar to the British electorate as a whole. So UKIP has been able to tap into this strain of xenophobia and fear, you know, various threats, economic, security, cultural threats of immigrants very effectively. And to some extent, of course, the Tories do the same thing.
But while victimizing and scapegoating the immigrants from Poland, etc., you also have, on the other side, if you will, counter leverage, if that's the right way to put it. You've got all of those Brits living in the south of France and in Spain in particular, who are depending upon their pensions, etc., and suddenly they're going to be left high and dry. So are they a political constituency?
I think they are. And this point about EU nationals living in Britain and, of course, Brits living elsewhere in the EU is an interesting one. And, of course, it's something that is very much involved with the Brexit negotiations that are forthcoming. That's one of the sort of big, you know, it's a pawn on both sides, if you will. It's sort of leverage on both sides, as you suggest. And so it's definitely going to play a role going forward. But, you know, again, May has made signals that she is going to try to work this out so that these people, you know, living in Italy and Spain and the south of France won't have to worry. And so she's tried to cover that base. We'll see how effective it is, but they're certainly aware of this.
Well, what's happening in terms of, we know that there's an election going on in France that's going to be closely watched over this weekend, and then you've got lots of reports now prior coming out of the Netherlands of Russian interference in those elections or trying to influence them through this racist fellow Wilders. And we know that Farage and UKIP have taken money from the Russians. What's the situation now in the broader sense? Is that still ongoing? Is there any still that kind of influence that's not necessarily, well, it's certainly mendacious. Obviously, Putin wants to weaken Western Europe. And even here in California, we found out that the person in charge of the California secession movement lives in Russia.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know,
I hadn't heard that one.
Oh, yeah. No, and he's obviously, you know, part of the Putin strategy to cause trouble wherever they can. So where does that stand in terms of, because it's astounding to me that the British are going along with this ridiculous, unnecessary move. Now they seem to be accepting it. And I wonder whether they recognize that the fingerprints on this Brexit.
They don't seem to. That this, you know, I follow the press quite closely in the polls. And that is basically very much unlike what has happened here in the last 4 months or so. It's very much off the radar screen in the UK in terms of polling, the press, public discussion, and you just don't see it. And you know, it's quite interesting, the contrast. The contrast is very sharp with the between the US and the UK in this regard.
In the sense that even though Donald Trump's been able to distract the public with dropping bombs on Syria and Afghanistan and threatening war with North Korea, the Russian story is not going away, but it's not a big deal in the UK.
It's not a big deal in the UK. It may be in part because, of course, while UKIP won nearly 13% of the popular vote in the last, that is the 2015 general election, they only got one seat and, of course, have no role in government whatsoever. And in fact, that one MP, Douglas Carswell, has now, you know, reneged on UKIP and is going to run as an independent. And so it may well be that their status is just so different from what we see in the U.S. that, you know, that people just aren't following this. And, of course, as far as I know, the only complaints about the Conservatives in the 2015 campaign, and this appears to have been documented, is that they violated the official spending rules in the constituency where they were opposing Nigel Farage, and then in a couple of other places as well. But that certainly doesn't involve the Russians. That's just sort of domestic, kinds of things going on. And so it's quite a different, quite a different setup.
Well, there's been a call, though, for these MPs, these Conservative MPs, who are at the centre of this police inquiry into electoral spending irregularities. There's been a call for them to be barred from standing for re-election. So, but May's backing these MPs. Is that going to make a difference, do you think?
I don't think so. I don't think so because their opposition was, of course, UKIP and the public as a whole, and certainly the vast, bulk of the press are not particularly favorable, particularly the quality press towards UKIP. And of course, as I say, there's no Russian connection there. So it's a different kind of thing, and I don't think it's going to play very heavily. But if it looks like May's going to win big, she'll cut those guys off at the knees just as fast as can be, of course. She is very, very self-interested and would not sacrifice herself or her interests for one moment for those guys.
Don't mess with the vicar's daughter, right?
Yeah, she appears to be. I've never, of course, never met her, but she appears to be really tough and almost ruthless, really.
Right. Well, it's just in closing, though. It's so bizarre to think that UKIP has just sort of gone into irrelevance that. And Farage is such a wanker and so despised. And yet, look at the damage they've done. They actually got Brexit through. And
they did. He had been working, of course, since 1993 to try to achieve this. And, of course, who would have ever thought that this would have happened? Even on the night of the election himself, he thought that he had lost and, left the pub early, unusual for him. And then someone had to, basically come back to him and say, look, you better get up again and get out here because it looks like we're going to win.
Well, Harold Clark, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. It's always a pleasure to chat with you and, look forward to next time.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. He's the author of Affluence, Austerity and Electoral Change in Britain and Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. And his latest book, just coming out next week from Cambridge University Press, is Brexit: Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. We can take a brief station break and be back speaking with the author of a new book, The Right's Road to Serfdom: The Danger of Conservatism Unbound, From Hayek to Trump.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christopher Arndt, who is a former partner at Select Equity Group, Inc., who in 2010 turned his attention to public policy issues, focusing in particular on accelerating the adoption of clean energy. He has served as director of the New York Chapter of Environmental Entrepreneurs and currently serves on the board of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC's Action Fund. He's the author of the new book, The Right's Road to Serfdom: The Danger of Conservatism Unbound, From Hayek to Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Arndt.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And people have warned before about this sort of, well, in fact, Warren Buffett referred to, he said once that America's in danger of becoming a plantation economy. And I guess given that the Republican Party, the GOP, has been taken over by Southerners, who have, there's vestiges of feudalism, certainly in the South, do you see this country sort of economically divided or heading in that direction, in effect, going back to a sort of a pre-Civil War division? Because after all, it was the British Tories, the Royalists, who supported the Confederacy.
Yeah, well, I think what's difficult about today, there is an issue of income inequality. But when you mention a plantation, an economy, what you also think of is privilege. And, you know, the foundation of one of the cornerstones of our liberal democracy is an even set of rules that apply to all. And one of the things that I do in my book, The Right's Road to Serfdom, is I make the point that there's two political traditions on the American right. And there's a political tradition of conserving the principles on which our country was founded. But there's also an older conservatism, a monarchical conservatism, which stands by privilege. And I think that is one of the drivers on the American right today, and that's one of the biggest issues that we now face.
Well, certainly the Republican Party is no longer the party of the northeastern elites. The Rockefeller Republicans are entirely extinct. So it has changed, clearly. And do you see any way that there can be a comeback from the traditional conservatives to wrest power back from the Tea Party and the southern wing of the party?
Yeah, I think to get ourselves back on the right track where, you know, both sides are, so to speak, playing on the field of a liberal democracy, and we don't have one of our political parties, or at least the major power centers of our political parties, you know, represented by a leader like Donald Trump, very much pushing against some of the norms of a liberal democracy, is, and I make this case in the final chapter of my book, we need to start thinking about government in ways how it supports political freedom. The title of my book is The Right's Road to Serfdom. That's a reference to an older book called The Road to Serfdom that was written by F.A. Hayek, and that book was a touchstone for conservatives for decades and decades. His argument at the time was that the political left had, or factions of it, had gone too far and thought the government should be involved in everything. You know, my book is a reference to the title of that, but I argue that the pendulum has swung the other way. And one of the biggest issues that we have is kind of a fundamentalist belief or enthusiasm on the right to always be against government. And if we're always against government, this has swung in such a way that we start to be suspicious of and, in fact, directly undermine the government institutions that are required for a free society.
Well, of course, it is a great irony that the Donald Trump, he has a cabinet essentially full of billionaires, but he got elected on all kinds of populist promises, and it seems that his supporters are going to have to learn the hard way, but we, the rest of us, and after all, the majority, over 3 million more people voted for the other candidate, will be collateral damage in this unfortunate exercise. But my sense, Christopher, is that things are going to get an awful lot worse in terms of deregulation, in terms of turning us on the road towards serfdom. For example, the new FDA appointee, they're going to lift the requirement for testing drugs, which means that the pharmaceutical companies will be able to test drugs themselves. And 9 out of 10 drugs tested don't meet the effectiveness. There's two standards, safe and effective. Safe means that they can't kill you and they're supposed to heal you, but effective means they have to actually work. And apparently, according to FDA's records, that 9 out of 10 drugs submitted to the FDA are proven not to be effective. So in effect, you remove that provision, which is a role that government plays and should play, people will be buying useless drugs. I mean, I bring that up because it seems such a flagrant example of how far off the rails we are heading in this sort of anti-government jihad.
Yes, I agree. We're on a dangerous path. I think if we're looking for a silver lining right now, you know, nobody would say the our political system was completely healthy prior to Trump. But sometimes an infection or something new can stimulate an immune response that ultimately leads to a healthier patient, if that analogy makes sense. And we have seen a pretty, in the first 100 days here, strong response, immune response. And, you know, the question is how much that can be sustained through the 2018 elections. I also think that, you know, if people start to recognize that government does have a fundamental role in a liberal democracy and that our institutions are important, and we can start to focus on solving common interests, then that, you know, in applying government where it needs to be active, not everywhere, but because it can certainly overreach, I think that starts to allow a basis for bipartisan cooperation. The problem is if you kind of hold this jihad against government, as you described it accurately, you don't focus on common problems or solving common interests, but you start to focus on demonizing government even further or focusing on an external menace, whether real or made up, and really playing to our worst angels. So I think, you know, the key is dispensing with this philosophy that government is always the problem. This is something I call the freedom fraud. And thinking about government where it really does reinforce the institutions that support liberty.
Well, Christopher, when you talk about making up demons and false fears, to my mind, there's nothing more extraordinary than how we are manipulated in terms of our fear of terrorism when statistics indicate that you're much, much more likely to be hit by lightning than you are killed by a terrorist. And the statistics are extraordinary, how rare, how few people are affected by terrorism. Yet we are so afraid of terrorism, and we're so afraid now of North Korea, and we're afraid of Syria, and we're afraid of, you know, ISIS and all of these external enemies, most of which don't amount to much. Yet the one thing that threatens not just us here in the United States, but the entire planet is global warming, and that's a real threat, and that will soon happen, and won't be long before the waves will be lapping at the doorstep of Mar-a-Lago down there in Florida. So how do you explain the fact that we Americans are so easily manipulated by these false and phony fears, or at least exaggerated fears, and can't face, and particularly the Trump people who are all in denial about global warming, can't face the real fear, which is a real and present danger, global warming?
Yeah, so I think what we have that is unique in the United States is a mix of special interest influence on our government, but that's linked to a false idea of freedom and a false ideology. And it's those two things working together that are ultimately very powerful. So people have talked about the Koch brothers and their spending on the political system as almost another political party, in the half of the, close to $800 million of spending. Special interests are always a threat to a liberal democracy, but what makes, I think, the Koch brothers' spending particularly potent is it's joined with this false idea of freedom. And, you know, one thing that I would hope Democrats would start to do a better job of is talk about their political priorities in terms of freedom and in terms of the American ideal of liberty. Really the American right has taken that idea, which is a fundamental idea, and special interests have used that for their own interests. And that's one of the reasons why we're, say, unique in the world in our current president not recognizing global warming as a real threat. You know, that's been a long political campaign, which started in the late 1980s to characterize freedom in a certain way, which benefited special interests, fossil fuel interests in particular.
Well, clearly the Koch brothers, even though their mantra is freedom, it's freedom for corporations. And of course, corporations were made persons in law. And now we have another corporatist on the Supreme Court. So it does seem odd that the real God-made man is being sort of subjugated, if you will, to the man-made God. But in the broadest sense, though, when you talk about the freedom fraud, as you do in your book, Christopher Arndt, The Right's Road to Serfdom, The Danger of Conservatism Unbound from Hayek to Trump, I recall, though, when the last address that FDR gave, he gave this speech called, I think it was called The Four Freedoms or something. I can't remember the number of the freedoms, but they were essentially like freedom from hunger, freedom to have shelter, freedom to have a job, freedom to have healthcare. Can you go back to FDR and inculcate the notion of freedom into those things that, as again, social democracies take for granted? And one, of course, it's no small irony that one of the greatest moves that the United States ever made was the Marshall Plan at the end of World War II. And we restored democracy in Western Europe and in Japan, and we installed social democracy in Germany and Japan. But we don't have it at home, but they have it. The Germans have, 6 weeks vacation, complete health care, and they've got an extremely robust economy.
Yeah, well, in my book, I talk about three or four, actually, spheres where, government has a role in the economy. And the first two spheres are really about limiting arbitrary power. And this is where, and that's about restraint. Freedom, civil freedom, is fundamentally about restraint and limiting arbitrary power. So a large corporation or authoritarian can't do whatever they want to do to us. You know, we have inalienable rights. They can't torture us. Or, a large corporation can't pollute on us. Those are kind of the fundamental pillars of a liberal democracy. On top of that, we can talk about where government has an expanded role, in terms of a welfare capacity. And, in that area, I think there's, on the playing field of liberal democracy, there's a, different sides, and we can have a reasonable debate about how far the government can and should go to provide a safety net for most people. But, my concern is not about that segment necessarily, but it's about you know, fundamental principles of restraint and the rule of law, of political pluralism, of facts that are common to all, and of a restrained defensive military, which is under civilian control. Those are kind of the four pillars of a liberal democracy. And, you know, the concern that I had that you could start to see on the American right going back to the early 2000s and has culminated or really further enabled under Trump is, you know, much of the enthusiasm for his candidacy is for a single person, you know, a lone strongman to solve our problems and for him to do whatever he wants to do to solve those problems. And that type of freedom of an individual just to do whatever they want to do, that stands directly in contrast to the principles of a liberal democracy.
Well, Donald Trump just congratulated this despot who won a rigged election in Turkey, Erdogan, and half the population are furious, and the Europeans are furious and said that the whole thing was rigged and there wasn't a level playing field. But Donald Trump goes ahead and congratulates this guy, undercutting half of the population of Turkey. So I think we've already seen both his authoritarian tendencies, but also his disregard for democratic values.
Yeah, and I think it's you could go even further than disregard to democratic values. And, you know, and I don't use the word authoritarian or autocrat lightly, but authoritarians have common characteristics. They tend to jail or threaten to jail political opponents. They make blatant lies as a show of power. They don't believe in inalienable rights, and they often resort to cruel and unusual punishment or torture. They don't respect religious toleration, and in fact, they use religious division for their own political advantage. And they promote a strident kind of resentful nationalism. And so we see a lot of these things in Donald Trump right now. You know, it may be surprising to have the President of the United States just as the position to be congratulating Erdogan or, you know, giving Putin a pat on the back. But, you know, this is actually what Donald Trump ran on in a certain sense, is a very strongman type narrative, which is everything is horrible and I alone can fix it. And we're surrounded by enemies and I alone can protect you. So there's an enthusiasm for this type of authoritarianism or to rule in this authoritarian way. And, you know, we have to realize this is not a drill. This is where we are, and we have to methodically work our way back towards, you know, again, kind of a playing field, I would call it, that's based on, you know, basic values of a liberal democracy.
Well, Christopher Arndt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, I thank you for your time.
And again, I'm speaking with Christopher Arndt, who's a former partner at Select Equity Group, Inc., who in 2010 turned his attention to public policy issues, focusing in particular on accelerating the adoption of clean energy. He has served as director of the New York Chapter of Environmental Entrepreneurs and currently serves on the board of the Natural Resource Defense Council, the NRDC's Action Fund, and he's the author of the new book, The Right's Road to Serfdom, The Danger of Conservatism Unbound, From Hayek to Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.